the sun was high over the brick-lined walkways of the historic district. When the first concussive blast fractured the afternoon peace, it was a Monday in June, the kind of day where the air sits heavy and still, carrying the scent of asphalt and summer dust. I remember looking at the clock and seeing it was just after one. People were scattered across the plaza, some eating lunch under umbrellas, while others moved between the storefronts that lined the square. The sound did not immediately register as a threat to most, but for those of us trained to listen, the sharp crack was unmistakable. It was followed quickly by a second, then a third, echoing off the historic facades and sending birds scattering from the rooftops. Within seconds, the casual rhythm of the shopping district collapsed into a frantic scramble for cover. Screams began to punctuate the silence between shots. As the reality of the situation took hold, in the center of the square, near the library, the movement was no longer random. It was a targeted, violent disruption of a quiet Colorado afternoon. The first person to fall was a man who had dedicated nearly two decades to the safety of this community, and his absence was felt the moment he hit the ground. It would take several minutes for the rest of us to understand that the chaos had only just begun. The quiet was gone, replaced by the mechanical cycle of a weapon and the desperate breaths of those hiding behind parked cars. It was in this moment of absolute uncertainty that a 40-year-old man named Johnny Hurley decided to leave the safety of a nearby store and step into the line of fire. The timeline of the afternoon began at 1:15, when a call for a welfare check was dispatched for a residence on the outskirts of the city. A family member had reported a man in a state of crisis, claiming he intended to do something drastic. Officer Gordon Beasley, a veteran school resource officer working patrol for the summer, was the first to receive the assignment. He was known in the community for his calm demeanor and his ability to connect with the local youth. Beasley arrived at the suspect's home, but the driveway was empty and the house was silent. Unbeknownst to the responding units, the subject of the call had already departed for the downtown area. At 1:30, a silver truck pulled into a parking lot adjacent to the old town square. The driver emerged, carrying a semi-automatic shotgun. He moved with a deliberate pace toward the library, bypassing several civilians. Beasley had just arrived at the square for a separate matter when he spotted the man. He stepped out of his patrol car to investigate. Before he could even reach for his radio, the suspect fired twice. The veteran officer fell instantly. The suspect then returned to his truck, exchanged the shotgun for an AR-15 rifle, and began firing into the air and at empty patrol cars. I was stationed in the administrative building nearby when the radio traffic erupted. We could see the movement from our vantage point, but the layout of the square made direct intervention difficult without a clear line of sight. The suspect was wearing a black t-shirt and a bucket hat, moving between the dumpsters and the parked vehicles. He seemed to be looking for more targets in uniform. While we prepared to breach the exterior door, a man in a red t-shirt appeared from the direction of the Army surplus store. He was low to the ground, moving with a tactical precision that suggested prior training. He took a position behind a brick wall and waited for the suspect to emerge from behind a vehicle. As the gunman stepped out to move toward the center of the square, the man in the red shirt fired six rounds from a concealed handgun. Five of those rounds struck the target, ending the immediate threat to the public. The primary evidence in the investigation consisted of high-definition surveillance footage from multiple angles and the forensic recovery of the weapons involved. In the immediate aftermath of the initial exchange, the scene was a labyrinth of spent casings and abandoned personal belongings. I moved toward the east exit of our substation, my weapon drawn as I scanned for any secondary shooters. Through the glass, I observed the individual in the red shirt approaching the downed suspect. He was not acting aggressively toward the civilians who were beginning to peek out from behind cover. Instead, he reached down and secured the suspect's AR-15. From my perspective, the situation was fluid and lacked clear identification. The individual held the rifle in one hand and his handgun in the other. He appeared to be inspecting the chamber of the rifle, likely attempting to render the weapon safe. I saw him begin to remove the magazine, a standard procedure for disarming a recovered firearm. However, from the rear and at a distance, the visual was different. it appeared as though a man in civilian clothing was now in possession of a high-powered rifle in an active scene where a fellow officer had just been killed. My colleague opened the door and fired 3 rounds. The man in the red shirt was struck in the pelvis and collapsed. He had been holding the rifle for approximately 11 seconds before the shots were fired. During the forensic sweep, we recovered a note left by the initial gunman in his truck. It contained explicit threats against law enforcement, stating that his goal was to kill as many officers as possible. The handgun used by the civilian was a legal concealed carry weapon, and he had fired it with remarkable accuracy under extreme stress. We also recovered the magazine he had successfully removed from the rifle just before he was hit. The forensic evidence confirmed that the threat from the initial gunman had been neutralized entirely by the civilian intervention. The area was cordoned off for several days as the critical incident response team mapped the trajectory of every round fired during the 3-minute duration of the event. The legal fallout from the afternoon was extensive and lasted for over 2 years. An independent investigation was conducted by the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office to ensure there was no conflict of interest within the local department. The district attorney reviewed over 3,000 photographs and 1,000 pages of reports before making a final determination. In November of that year, the district attorney's office announced that no criminal charges would be filed against the officer who fired the final shots. The ruling was based on the legal standard of a reasonable belief of imminent danger, citing the chaotic nature of the scene and the fact that the officer had only seconds to process the sight of a civilian holding an assault rifle near a fallen officer. The department officially recognized Johnny Hurley as a hero, acknowledging that his actions prevented a much larger loss of life. In September of 2023, the city reached a settlement with the Hurley family, totaling $2,800,000. As part of the agreement, both parties committed to exploring a permanent memorial in the square to honor the lives lost that day. Officer Beasley was laid to rest with full honors, attended by thousands of community members and law enforcement from across the region. The suspect was confirmed to have acted alone, fueled by a documented history of animosity toward the police. The square has since returned to its usual pace, but the brickwork near the library remains a point of reflection for those who remember the sounds of that afternoon. The investigation was officially closed following the settlement, leaving a legacy of complicated questions regarding the intersection of civilian intervention and law enforcement response. The facts remain on the record as a chronological account of a tragedy that redefined the local understanding of heroism and its often unpredictable consequences.